This election season is a lot of things, but one thing it's not is much fun. Unless you really enjoy insults, lies, and leaks. I'm Anne Strandchamps, and this is a problem because not only are a lot of us sick of the election, a whole lot of us won't even vote. Voter turnout in America currently lags way behind most other established democracies. In Belgium, Turkey, Sweden, and South Korea, it's over 80%. In the U.S., it's about 53%. So clearly, something's missing from our political process, something more than just ballots.
What has been missing is this deep sense that participation in politics and engagement in civic life, and voting in particular, ought to be a joyful communal experience.
This is Eric Liu. He's the founder of Citizen University, a nonprofit that aims to reinvigorate the culture of voting by reintroducing Americans, us, to our own civic power. Eric, you wrote this great piece in The Atlantic, I think, a few years ago. I still remember it. And you described elections in America historically, like, I don't know, 100, 150 years ago, as like a big party. Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, actually, for most of American history, until pretty much the advent of television, there was this deep, robust, raucous participatory culture of voting that was about street theater and parties and open-air debates and festivals and competing parades and theatricality and spectacle. There's a deep, deep tradition in American life of people treating voting not as some grim, solitary duty, but as something that is joyful and collective and something that we want to be part of.
Did that surprise you when you first started reading some of that history or doing the research?
You know, it did and it didn't. It didn't because if you think back to some of the signal moments in American political history, the pre-revolutionary era, and you think about this very fertile, fervent culture of pamphleteering and outdoor orations and people beginning to make their views known on the question of revolution and independence. And then you fast forward to something like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and, you know, that was the entertainment of its day. Thousands of people crowding into a square just to hear world-class oratory on the issues of the day.
Of course, you're describing a lot of the campaign seasons, and yes, the campaign season now, especially this year, is very negative, but there's still, it's ripe fodder for comedy. There's stuff all over social media, so people are pretty engaged. I'm not sure we feel that way about voting. The day you have to actually drag yourself to the polls, that's, you know, kind of just a moral responsibility.
You know, you're right that voting itself can seem like this moral, grim duty that particularly in this election where a lot of people are unhappy with all their choices at the presidential level. But I think this is something deeper than just voting. To me, voting, the act of casting the ballot, you know, shouldn't be the be-all and end-all. That's just this crystallizing moment. And what precedes that crystallizing moment is, in the best case, a communal civic ritual that activates passion and purpose and collective identity and joy. And then after that moment, keeps you engaged in ways that are not just about being a spectator, but being a co-author, a creator of civic life.
Can you tell me about a couple of the projects that you've gotten started? You've got this whole Make Elections, Make Voting Fun Again campaign at a pretty local level.
They're actually all at the local level. And this is a project that my organization, Citizen University, runs called The Joy of Voting. So in Miami, one of the projects is about young people organizing these all-night dance parties with really great DJs and performers, where the only way you get in is to show that you're registered to vote. In Akron, Ohio, kids are creating plays about elections and politics, and they're performing these plays on the back of a pickup truck that goes from neighborhood to neighborhood throughout Akron. In Philadelphia, there's a great scavenger hunt that is elections-themed all through Colonial Old Town. And in Wichita, local residents and artists are creating mixtapes and graffiti art that's about both getting out the vote and reminding people why voting matters. And again, in the best sense, what voting is, the bigger picture that voting is part of.
I notice in a lot of these cases, there's art and theater involved in some way. I'm guessing that's deliberate. Is it something about wanting to link voting with, I don't know, the act of imagination?
It's no accident. When you roll back to ancient Athens, democracy and theater emerged around the same time. the idea of public life, of being a citizen and acting in public, is so bound up with the theatricality and the idea of capturing and activating imagination on stages of various kinds. And so from the very start, democracy and theater and art, I think, have been really woven together. And if you think about just any modern-day campaign, and you think about the iconic sounds or sights of those campaigns, you think of art. You think of Shepard Fairey's image of Barack Obama and Hope in 2008. Mm-hmm. You think about the colonial garb that Tea Party activists decked themselves out in when they began to show up at town meetings and really fight for their view of a restored constitutionalism. This is not just about left or right. I think people have this deep human instinct to activate art and imagination and creativity, again, in public.
Why does that bodies in the street thing matter to you? Why does it matter to you that this is in person, in a place?
That's such a great question. You know, I think it matters particularly in our age, where so much of our lives, are mediated, and we deal with one another through our screens. We literally are not seeing each other with our heads and necks craned looking down at our smartphones. And although social media makes many wonderful things possible at a scale and with a speed that wasn't previously possible, if you think about the emergence of both the Tea Party and Black Lives Matter, or, groups like Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, all these things emerged out of social media, and that's great. But at the end of the day, just as at the beginning of the day, face-to-face matters most in democracy. Democracy and self-government are about relationships. They're about the capacity for seeing one another, empathizing with one another. You know, I think in a country as diverse and far-flung as ours, there is so little naturally holding us together. And the only way to build these deep bonds of trust is to see one another.
Yeah, that's such an interesting comment, because I'm thinking about how many people today, and sometimes I'm one of them, feel pretty cynical about the entire democratic process in America and don't really think their individual votes are going to matter all that much. You know, the deck is already stacked. The campaigns mm-hmm. are run by a cadre of professional operatives. They're supported by armies of big data miners and funded by special interests and big money. And on the face of that, you know, wearing an I voted sticker just that seems kind of futile.
I don't deny that it seems kind of futile. And I don't want to deny this sense of deep cynicism that lots of people have. I mean, heck, Anne, if you, as civically engaged as you are feeling that, just think about all the people who have been disengaged and felt disenfranchised, and how profoundly they must feel like it's a joke and my vote doesn't count and why bother. But the two responses I have are number one, it may feel that way in a national election where votes are counted in the tens of millions. But where this really matters, think about your town, your city, your community. In a country where in most local elections, turnout hovers at about 20%. If you decided that you wanted to get you and your friends' friends to actually vote and show up in a local election, just you and your social network literally could turn the tide in a local election. That's enough to get a different kind of council member, to get a different kind of interest represented, to get a different array of power at your local level.
Well, this is the real underlying issue, isn't it? It's about power. And you've said in a bunch of different places that one of the big problems you think facing American democracy right now is that a lot of Americans have become illiterate in power. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. You know, I think power, just that word. I mean, I bet some of our listeners, as we're talking about this now, their hackles have gone up. Power is a dirty word in American life, and all of our associations with power are kind of negative. People are power hungry or power mad or on power trips. And I think one of the most basic responsibilities that we have as citizens is to be able, with unflinching eyes, to name, to understand, to be able to read and write power. And so if you have any qualms or misgivings about the topic, or feel like it is sordid and the kind of thing that really, you know, scummy operatives to engage in, or people who are stabbing each other in the back, you got to get over that. Power is all around us at all times. We are either exercising it or we are unconsciously giving it away at all times. The illiteracy of so many people in how power works, what forms it takes, who has it, who does not have it, why that is, how it flows, even in the most basic sense, how we define it, right? When I talk about power, I mean simply a capacity to ensure that others do as you would like them to do.
But I don't understand what you mean, because we live in a country right now where the real political power is concentrated in the hands of a few powerful people. That's just a fact. I don't think saying that I should learn more about power, I don't understand what that would do.
Well, I think there are two cases in point that challenge that perspective at the national level. One is called Bernie Sanders, and one is called Donald Trump. Now, neither of them may end up, certainly one of them won't end up being president of the United States, and it may turn out that neither of them does. But both of these individuals have tapped into a deep upswell of both yearning and anger and ambition and desire for change among people fully across the political spectrum and across the generational spectrum. Tens of millions of people in this country who felt exactly as you just articulated, Anne, that I'm powerless and the game is so rigged and a few people control it, decided to get together and decided to not only exercise their vote, but actually to show up in person, in places, with passion, and created contagions that made millions of other people get on board. That's one simple national example. But another one is, again, not about elections, but about movement politics. To me, one of the most exciting realities of our time right now is that we are in a new wave of reckoning with our history of institutional and structural racism. And so Black Lives Matter as a movement is, to me, one of the most hopeful exhibits of citizen power that's unfolding in our country right now. There is no headquarters for Black Lives Matter. There's no one person who you can say she or he is the CEO of Black Lives Matter. This is a completely decentralized, networked movement of particularly young people, and particularly young people of color, who don't have clout, who don't have the connections, who don't have office, who don't have money, and yet they've been able completely to upend our political narratives. They've been able to put criminal justice and policing reform front and center into the national debate. And you can agree or disagree with their objectives and their policy platforms, but you cannot deny that these activists, these young activists, have changed the game. That is power in action.
So what you're saying, it sounds like, is you're offering a counter-narrative to this cynical version of where we've gotten to, which says that everything is rigged and power is concentrated in the hands of a few people. And you're saying that we're actually seeing, in fact, a movement that is returning power to the hands of the people, or the people taking it back.
Yes, or not giving it away. This is going to sound a little bit philosophical, maybe even spiritual, but I think it is simply a truth, which is that power is a gift. We begin with a certain measure of power, all of us, even the ones who seem to have the least in material ways. And consciously or not, we are continuously either giving that power away or we are directing it and circulating it intentionally. For instance, back to voting, when you decide that, boy, the system is so rigged and the choices are terrible and this whole thing is corrupt, I'm not going to bother voting, that's a fantasy. There is no such thing as not voting.
What do you mean?
Not voting is voting. It is voting to hand over your power and your voice to other people whose interests are most likely going to be inimical to your own. There is no passivity in this stuff.
Why does the local level matter so much in this?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. And number one, even though so much of American politics has become nationalized by talking points machines and the professionals you alluded to and our kind of national media, at the end of the day, you know, we live in a place where things are either going to work or not, right? There isn't a Republican or a Democratic way to collect garbage. There isn't a way that can be just reduced to party posturing on the question of how you deal with traffic or how you deal with homelessness. These are hard, unavoidable, concrete choices, trade-offs, and problems that a community living together has to deal with. And so if you think about just the simple question, who runs your town? Who runs your town? I don't mean just who's the mayor, who's the city manager. If you do kind of a more extensive mapping of power in your town, and you think about, well, it's these developers, or it's this university president, or it's this really, you know, billionaire, or it's this union boss, or whatever it might be. The question of who runs this town is one that you're far more able to change not only the narrative of, but the facts on the ground of by participating.
Is that what you mean when you talk about becoming power literate as opposed to power illiterate? Simply knowing to begin with, say, mapping the power in your local community. How much do you know about it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, we use a phrase oftentimes in everyday life. We talk about the power structure, right? But what is the power structure? I break down the power structure into this combination of sources of power plus the conduits of power. You know, there are various sources of power, whether that's money power, people power, the power of force and violence, the power of state action, the power of social norms, right? There are all these different sources, but what are the conduits through which they flow? In some communities, the main conduits are going to be formal channels like the Chamber of Commerce or the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. In other communities, it's not going to be that so much. The conduits of power are going to be, you know, this lunch table at the steakhouse where the third Tuesday of every month, you know, a few bankers and big shots get together and map out what's going to happen. Mapping those sources and conduits is what I mean by being literate in power, being literally able to see these flows all around you. It's like, you remember the movie The Matrix at the end when the Matrix becomes visible, right, to Neo, and you see that continuous stream of data and bits and the flow all around you. Like, just envision that, man. I mean, that's happening all around us. And if we start seeing that flow, that suffusing flow of power and our ability actually to redirect it, that changes both mindset and action.
Well, and of course, we're lucky enough to live in an age where the web and social media have created an entirely new set of conduits, which are profoundly democratic because anybody can take part in them. Are you seeing instances where local communities are going around the existing national power structures and working with each other to make things happen?
There is a phenomenon going on in the country right now, driven in good measure by what you just described, Anne, which is our network technologies of our time. And this phenomenon I just shorthand as networked localism. So let's take a couple of examples. In Seattle, where I'm from, I was one of the citizens very involved in our successful push to get a $15 minimum wage established in the city. And yes, that required a lot of mapping and activating of power that was specific to this particular place. But as we did so, we were networked up with other citizens, scholars, activists, catalysts in cities all around the United States, in the Bay Area, in New York, and Chicago, all around the country, who were doing similar kinds of organizing and planning and policy development. And we were exchanging notes and sharing strategies. And once we were able to get $15 across the goal line here in Seattle, people from other cities came to us and worked with us and learned about what they could borrow from our playbook and apply to their own arena in their communities. And this is happening on issue after issue.
To circle back to a couple of things we began with, fun and adding a sense of play back to the whole electoral democratic process and the notion of imagination, you created an exercise a while ago, kind of thought experiment that you challenged people to try. And I wanted to invite our listeners to do this, and maybe you could explain.
Sure. One of the most simple but challenging exercises I think we as citizens can do is just to write a narrative of what your city could look like in the future. How, if power were truly circulated equitably and people had more wherewithal, more opportunity to participate more fully in the civic life of your community, what would that look like? Paint that picture. That is an act of imagination, as almost any moment of transformation in politics demands and requires. And when you begin to depict what that city looks like, and it can be in 3 years, it can be in 30 years, but when you begin to make that depiction in your mind and then start telling that story to other people, I mean this in the most profound sense, it becomes self-fulfilling. Right. Any political movement of the last half century, whether it was the conservative movement or the civil rights movement, all of these movements began with people basically telling and writing down this kind of narrative, envisioning what that polity of the future would look like, and then working backwards from that and thinking, OK, who and what do we need to mobilize in order to get from here to there?
Eric Liu is the founder and CEO of Citizen University. He was a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton. I'm Anne Strain-Champs, and this conversation is part of a longer series we're doing on how to reinvent elections. The hour-long special will be out October 30th on To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI.